Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. Where I want to start this Talky Bit, this exploration, is with a bit of an orienting statement about what feels to me like a rather large detail in this particular exploration. Today is, of course, Mother's Day. So I want to explore something that's connected with that. And there might have been, I know there was, just because, among other things, I didn't say anything differently about it, but there was some expectation that I would continue this week with the very short history of hell topic that we started last week. But no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get those two topics to play nice together. I leave it to you to imagine some of the ridiculous rabbit trails that took me down. But that's not the orienting idea that I mean. I want to talk about a bit of a wider topic that I think embraces many aspects of what we might call mothering, but that isn't limited to many of the stereotypes that might be associated with that language. And here I think I might really want to sort of have my cake and eat it as well. I want to do that, and I want to do it without diminishing the unique role that we often think of when we think about mom or mother. So here's the idea. This has all sorts of problems, just so you know that I know. As far as I can tell, mothering can mean lots of different things. And some of those certainly match certain stereotypes that have to do with gender or gender-based roles. And I think that's great and lovely as far as it goes. There's so much to explore and celebrate within those ideas. And in an age of expanding understandings of gender and also changing understandings of what constitutes family, I don't wish to stop there. So on this particular Mother's Day, I want to consider some questions about nurturance, often but not always within the context of mothering and what we might broadly call the feminine. And in particular, I want to ask a couple of questions of my own tradition of origin around this. So the first of those questions is, in the stories that I heard growing up, particularly in the stories that were meant to help me imagine who God is and how the divine-human relationship works, where exactly were all the mothers? And if we're willing to start with that role but not stop there, where are the other caregivers? Where are the other figures of nurturance and compassion? And never mind in the First Testament, or if you prefer, Old Testament stories, where women are noteworthy primarily for their absence, although there are a couple of truly remarkable female characters tucked away in the margins, the majority of whom are celebrated because they did a great job of doing something that usually men did. That woman was a good judge, you know, kind of that, along with that sort of valence. But this is also true in the stories that we might think of as the Jesus stories, the gospel stories. Once we get past Mary and Elizabeth, whose roles are sparse once the babies arrive, and who are primarily celebrated for the men they carried into the world, there's a lot more male figures than otherwise in the stories. And for the most part, those male figures aren't particularly nurturing, even when they are the good guys. So let's take a story, just because that's very sweeping, let's take a story that has survived pretty intact even into this century, the story of the prodigal son. Now, that story is a parable. So it has a certain literary form, and parables are told to illustrate a particular truth or truths, and usually the tool that the storyteller uses to do that in that structure is contrast. They sit some things against one another that rub on one another. And in this particular case, the story's intent is to teach the listeners about God's love, forgiveness, and the importance of repentance.
Now, as a storyteller, I can appreciate the value of leaving out the irrelevant bits. I might not be good at it, but in theory, at least I appreciate it. It can make a story more memorable, more punchy. And I know that that happens in this story, and I also know that this is a story that is of its time. But that's part of the problem, isn't it? It is of its time, but we still, in many cases, might access it to illustrate the character and behavior of the divine relative to the character and behavior of humans. And the divine, most systems of belief would regard as being beyond time. So we have a timely story being used to teach us something in time about a character in the story that we wish to regard as beyond the vagaries of time. So, unless we either discard the story as no longer relevant of its time, which is a real option, or we're satisfied with the characterizations it offers, we have some work to do. Those are sort of the three big baskets. Now, because it's a family story, we kind of might think, what's the kind of big paradigm? Well, it's a family story, but there's no mother or mother figure anywhere to be found in that story, not even the shadow of one. It's dad and the two male sons, all the real humans. The only other characters in the story are the servants, and they have no meaningful role other than jumping to obey the father figure. That's what they do. And the father figure in the story, to be fair, is a pretty decent guy in context. He is a just judge, so that could be worse. But he also forgives his errant kid, and he welcomes him back with compassion. So that's good. But if you grew up with this story, or you've even heard it from a distance, have you ever wondered? Have you ever wondered why the kid left in the first place? You ever given that any time? Or why he was so terrified to come back home? He was absolutely convinced, as the story would have it, that his father, if he would have him back at all, would relegate him to the same status as the faceless servants. Or do you ever wonder why he thought that groveling might be the best or the only approach? Come home. We could also consider the wider dysfunctions of the family as they're revealed by the story we have. We have brothers that are estranged, the good one working tirelessly to try to make sure he gets his fair share from his father in the end, and then seething when it doesn't go the way he thinks it should, the father being just as heavy-handed and non-collaborative in his apparent generosity to his younger son as he has been non-communicative about his perspective to his oldest son throughout the entire story, as far as we know. Now, let's speculate. And just so you know, when we speculate about a story like this, we stand in a long tradition, if we were Jewish. A rich tradition of doing exactly this with these stories. But if we grew up around other approaches to the text, maybe not so much. Let's imagine, just for fun, that there is a mom or some other nurturing character that was part of this story. When I imagine that, I imagine that the story might then include some things like emotional or relational dimensions around themes like nurturing or reconciliation or family bonds. Or maybe we would see someone who characterized God as a parental figure as someone that worries over the absent son or tries to reach out to contact them or maybe mediates between the father and the older and younger sons, perhaps modeling forgiveness in circumstances in addition to the ones that are at the apex of the crisis in the narrative. But that's not how this story goes. And it's not how many others in the library go either. And so if we grew up surrounded by these stories, we grow up surrounded by images of God as a rule enforcer, as a punisher, as sometimes someone who relents and welcomes us despite our failures, for which we should all be grateful. And as long as we're using the prodigal son story as illustrative, have you ever noticed, I'm not assuming anything here, but just in case, have you ever noticed how much ink gets spilled on how truly gargantuan a screw-up the kid is? He doesn't make a couple of mistakes. Like, he ditches half the family fortune on, you know, raucous living. What's anybody remember the King James word for dissipation? That's the word. On dissipation. What are you doing? I'm dissipating. Don't bother me. Oh, my word. Anyway, right? He's a mess. And we make sure we're absolutely unapologetically, you know, hit over the head with the fact that he is. It sounds to me a little bit like that one. You know, that particular kid might have benefited from some nurturance before he had such a rough go of it, not just after. And I, when I kind of have that experience with this story, I feel as though there's an important question that's just sort of hanging in the air. And for me, the question is, how did it come to this? And that's a question that's just not given any space in the narrative. If we can assume anything from the story as we have it, the problem was with the kid's character. They're just a bad one. And if we really zoom out, that's a big question that's missing from many of the stories in the collection. How did it come to this? Having said that, some of these values that gesture toward the importance of connection, of bonds, of deliberate cultivation of those things, sort of poke their heads up in the collection for brief moments. And I don't mention this to try to redeem the text, which I have sort of no intrinsic drive to do, so much as to suggest the possibility that if we're referencing that library, the values have been there all along, but they have been sidelined by the patriarchal men and the patriarchal structures that are telling and transmitting the stories. And not to put too fine a point on it, but characterizing the divine as masculine has served the men running organized religion rather well, and in far too many instances continues to do so. Again, just watch the news. You know, it's not hard to find. I do find it intriguing, nevertheless, that we've had a large collection of men locked away in secret to choose another man to be the head of the largest Christian denomination on the planet, a denomination with an estimated 1.2 to 1.4 billion baptized members plus adherents, a good-sized swath of population. And I don't mention that to be uniquely critical of the Catholic Church, but it's just a rather high-profile example of a wider problem that we're exploring today, which is, as the title of the talkie bit says, the invisibility of the values that are often associated with nurturance in the story and the extensions of the story, the things we make of the stories. Now, I'd like to give some contrasting moments in history their due. And in light of that, I should mention the three places in the library of biblical stories that are noteworthy exceptions, textually, to what I've been talking about. Isaiah 66:13, for those of you that like these sorts of reference points, has a text in which the writer describes the Hebrew God as being, quote, like a mother that comforts her child. Lovely. Hosea 11, we find a description of God bending down to feed his chosen nation like an adult feeds a toddler. In Luke, noteworthy for being the most culturally open of the four Gospels, we find the story of Jesus expressing a longing to gather Jerusalem like a mother hen. Those are them. Not to put it another way, maybe this is a little bit mechanistic, but just because these things have impact, an average English translation of the Bible contains about 800,000 words. The three instances that I just mentioned take up about 200, which is roughly 0.025% of the collection. And yes, I did use a device to do that calculation. I also find it noteworthy that none of the images that I just mentioned are particularly empowering. They all feature a quite overt sense of divine parentalism. Perhaps it's fair to regard that as one lens into why the prevailing understandings of the divine in a world deeply informed by this collection of texts seem so tilted in one direction. This doesn't come from nowhere. And I'm going to say, millions will disagree, billions if my Catholic numbers are right, might disagree. I'm going to say that there's a reason for that. And we have something to do with it. It's because we've made something particular of the things we're looking to make our beliefs. Now, on the heels of that, historically, chronologically, on the heels of that, about 650 years ago, we find a quite remarkable instance of a Christian mystic who unapologetically takes a different approach. Some of you will be familiar, but let me recap the story. So the location for this story geographically is a small room, or what the monastic tradition calls a cell. It's attached to a church in Norwich, England. And in that room, there's a woman named Julian, who by all reports is near death. And as she's hovering tenuously between life and death, she has a series of vivid mystical visions. She calls them showings. And they are, for her as a Christian, visions of the love of God as expressed in Christ. Her notion of the divine is captured by that story. Now, as it turns out, she doesn't die. She eventually recovers. She spends the rest of her life living in that cell as an anchoress and reflecting on these visions, writing them down, creating, along the way, the first known, or at least the first surviving, book in English by a woman, which is called Revelations of Divine Love. 650 years ago. It's still in print. You can buy a copy on Amazon for $13.84. It'll be here by early next week. Right? It's still out there. Now, other than the fact that it was written by a woman, which is in itself a remarkable fact in context, there are a couple of other things that make it stand out. In a world where the dominant images of God were those of king, lord, and judge, Julian writes this, quote, "As truly as God is our father, so truly is God our mother." And just so we don't miss her point, both father and mother are capitalized. These days, we might say they get equal billing. And as you can imagine, that was, and I would still say is, a long way from the prevailing norms. It's extraordinary. Now, for Julian, this is not a metaphor. All right? This is a deep, abiding truth about the nature of the divine. In this work, she describes Christ as a mother who feeds us with his own body, who suffers labor pains for us, who nurtures us as a mother nurtures her child. Now, whether you regard Christ as an embodiment of the divine is, of course, an open question, a choice. But for Julian, it isn't. That's a choice that she's already made. The context for her is the assumption that that is the case, that Christ is the embodiment of the divine, and it's in that context that she gives voice to these convictions. She goes on to write this, quote, "The mother's service is nearest, readiest, and surest. For it is most true. It is he that loves us the most." And I've got to say, one of the things that I personally enjoy when I read Julian of Norwich is the unassuming way that she uses fluid pronouns and gender imagery. And she's not doing it to make a point. She's trying to find language for the visions she had. And that's how they operated. Christ, the mother, is sometimes he and sometimes she in the same sentence. She's trying to describe what she experienced, and she just hits the limits of language. And so she just flip-flops it. She's like, I don't know what else to do. This is how I experienced it. In Julian's vision, the maternal love of God is not soft or sentimental. It is fierce. It is patient. It is tireless. It's the kind of stuff that shows up on the supermom card, I'm afraid. Never stops loving, never stops supporting the child, no matter how much or how often the child stumbles. That's the way Julian characterizes that love in those showings. Now, if we're looking for a way to be dismissive about all of this, we could take the approach that we can only consider the sorts of possibilities I've pointed to here because we live at such a privileged point in history. A similar kind of perspective that we might use to dismiss, you know, the anxieties of the emerging generation as the whining of a bunch of spoiled brats. Kind of along the lines of, you know, when we were young, the road to school was uphill both directions and under 6 feet of snow. And by the way, we didn't have real shoes, you understand? But anyway, that's sort of a, you know, orientation to the story. We can't get away with that when it comes to Julian. During her lifetime, she lived through, and these are just the high points, the Black Death, the plague, mid-1300s. She lived through the Peasants' Revolt in 1381. She lived through the suppression of the Lollards, which was a proto-Protestant group that was demanding the reform of Western Christianity that got suppressed by having their leaders assassinated. So she lived by the church, just to keep it complicated. So she lived through plague, war, upheaval in her lifetime. She lived through power holders unreluctantly protecting their perspective and their holdings. She wasn't naive about suffering. And she also wasn't a venerated elder. She was in her mid-30s when she had these visions. And yet, in the midst of all of those challenges, she remained of the conviction that maternal love was the center of everything and that it was a center that would hold. She famously wrote, probably most famously wrote, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well." That is quite a conviction to hold in the middle of a collapsing world, isn't it? Never mind to hold as an outlier. Julian does not hold it as a holder of ecclesiastical power. She holds it as an anchoress writing a perspective from visions that were hers alone that is a complete outlier. Intriguingly, she also described herself in those same writings as a, quote, simple creature unlettered. She wouldn't have had formal schooling. We speculate that she probably learned English from a male sibling who would have had formal schooling. But it's a phrase that lots of Julian of Norwich scholars suggest she probably used to avoid antagonizing her readers, in particular her readers who held authority in the church hierarchy. Now, we don't have the sources necessary to defend what I'm about to suggest, but there is a part of me that simultaneously feels grateful she did what she may have needed to do to have her writings survive, because they remain powerful, and that at the same time laments the need for her to stay under the radar of patriarchal leadership and their guardianship of the prevailing images of the divine, just not to have her voice silenced. Don't mind me. I'm unlettered. 650 years later, I can't buy their book on Amazon. I'm just saying. Not like that's the measure of all things, but it's an interesting reflection of something. And again, for me, there's a question hanging in the air. How is it that we have this one, albeit remarkable, work and not a library full of the consideration of these perspectives? It's not because they're not possible. It's not because they're not present. It's not because they couldn't have been part of the way the stories were told. I recognize that much of the tone of this talky bit could be characterized as lament. Happy Mother's Day. I don't feel apologetic about that. From where I sit, there is a lot here to grieve. However, I also think that there is no better time to consider a different perspective than now. This is the moment we have. There is no better time to ask, how can we do better? This is the moment we have. So, let's consider just for a few moments what that might look like. Because I'm imagining something, I can leave out the possible ferocious downsides, but I don't think they're very hard to find, so I'm not too concerned about that. I want to be both specific enough to address some of the concerns that I've mentioned, and I also want to be general enough to be relevant to the considerable variety of belief systems that I know a community like this represents and touches. So let's start by returning to the prodigal story, but with a nurturing presence, which I'm going to characterize as a mother in it. Let's still keep the prodigal, who left to explore the world, as even the best-raised kids sometimes feel the need to do, at least if my best-raised kids are any indication. And some of these explorations have gotten them into some tough places, right? Maybe he didn't see it coming, maybe he did, but either way, he's in there. And it beat him up. Those difficult places that's been a rough ride. And he has come to the bottom of the curve, and so he's coming home. A little sidebar here. Some of you might remember me talking about a book called, it's been a couple of years ago, probably now, maybe many more than that, I don't know, a book called Untangled about parenting adolescent girls, which we found helpful in our home. One of the metaphors that author uses that remains enduring for me and that I've used in lots of conversations with parents who are, you know, rawr, is this image of a swimming pool, and that the parent is the edge of the pool, or we're the coping. We're the solid part. And one of the reasons our kids sometimes push off so hard is because they know the edge of the pool is solid. They know it's going to be there. And if they get out into deep water and they're like, whoa, boy, what did I do? They can swim back, right? They can be like, gotcha. It's huge, right? It's huge. So let's picture that, if you will, and picture the prodigal, and picture home being a place that has someone in it that feels like that to the prodigal. So the prodigal's coming home. They're still a mess. But they are coming home to someone who trusts grace and who trusts love. And because of that, the prodigal doesn't have to imagine a scenario where groveling is necessary. He can come home reasonably expecting, confident even, that what he will encounter is belonging and compassion, some relief from having to sort out all the complexities of life on his own. He can come home looking forward to being in a place of healing, a place of inclusion, a place of restoration. He knows that might include having to face some hard truths. That might include the necessity of boundary setting. That might include things that we might broadly characterize as tough love. Because the love he is coming back to is fierce, and it's protective, and it's wise. But above all else, he knows he is coming back to a place of embrace, a place where he will be held, a place where all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. On this Mother's Day, and always, I believe those are possibilities that are worth exploring. Peace.